We're talking with Robert Bigelow, the founder of Bix. You know, since he decided to launch Bix about 6 months ago, some pretty strange events have occurred involving Mr. Bigelow, his employees, his family members, and to the reporter who wrote the New York Times story that came out today. Is something trying to dissuade him from pursuing this subject? And how does it compare to the consequences, the very strange events that are associated with Skinwalker Ranch and all the years he spent on the property? We dig into Bix, NIDS, Skinwalker, OSAP, and more in this hour. We'll be right back. Robert, concerning the Bix essay contest, so you have to apply before you submit an essay, and then a panel of judges decides who gets to enter, but you want a broad spectrum of entries, so they're not going to exclude everyone, and you will award the nearly $1 million for these prizes later this year. It's not like somebody wrote to me and compared it to James Randi's, the Amazing or Amusing Randi's contest, $1 million for evidence of UFOs or paranormal, and he never awarded it. You're going to award this money, right?
We absolutely are. I'm not going to come down with writer's cramp at the last minute. That's not going to happen. We absolutely will. And we don't know if there's going to be other contests. We want to get through this our first rodeo to see how well everything is comes together. And we're going to be excited to write those checks and excited to have the people, if they want to come forward and maybe on your show, George, and talk about their essays, and that would be fantastic. That would be great.
Yeah, you're not going to stash these away in a vault somewhere. The essays will be published, maybe even some of the runners-up. I mean, you want to get the word out and encourage people to continue the research.
Well, the essays belong to the authors, right? So it's their property. We're asking for permission as an applicant and as an entry to the contest to put them up on our website. So we're asking for permission just to do that, and we'll try to encourage them to give interviews to whomever. And so, you know, that's all part of the idea to expand the field.
Bix, I guess, is an independent arbiter of the value of the evidence that will be submitted in the essays. But you have already sort of reached a conclusion. You think there is an afterlife. And you hope, I think, that some kind of communication can be established. Am I overstating that?
Well, let me back up. The Bix is not an arbiter of the success or failure of the arguments that the contestants are going to try to make. That's up to the five judges, and we have no control over those judges. We simply selected the best we could out of the people that we knew in the field and related areas where we thought these are people who are not easily fooled. And so we have five very good judges, and for better or worse, we have assigned to them that responsibility to make those decisions, and Bix has nothing to do with who is selected as the winners.
I know you had talked about you're gathering all the best evidence, the best research and books, everything that's been written on the topic. Am I overstating it to suggest that some of the best work was done 100 years ago when the leading minds of the time were all interested in this? And we're careful to try to confirm that there really was something going on. But then the topic became discredited because of phony mediums.
Yeah, I think you're right, George. I think there was a quality of scientific researchers back in the late 1800s, early 1900s that was profound. Then... it changed, as you say, through fraud was being committed, and then people who were legitimate and were not fraudulent were labeled and smeared with that same claim that they were committing fraud, and so it was never quite the same. I think the materialism of science, probably science has become a religion of sorts, all on its own, and so there's tremendous peer pressure. If you are a scientist who is studying weird things, you better put it in a brown bag and not let your friends at the university notice that you've got this book in your briefcase, or you're liable to be ostracized and asked to leave the university.
I want to talk about the consequences of this research, because you had shared with me privately of some really strange things that have happened since you kicked this off back in June of last year and started thinking about it. Things that happened to you, things that happened to your staff members, things that happened to family members. And then we saw that New York Times article, which is a very flattering profile of you. And at the end, Ralph Blumenthal writes that he had a really strange experience while working on the story, something that woke him up in the middle of the night and kind of spooked him a little bit. That fits the pattern, though, doesn't it?
It's part of the unexplainable with these kinds of phenomena, and you can chalk it up to serendipity, and you can say, well, just a matter of coincidence that you start something and it propagates outward to a lot of other folks, most of whom you know, and then branches out into people that you don't know. And what do you make of it? When does serendipity become too sophistic as an answer? Is it okay to have many things be serendipitous every single day, or where do you draw the line as to cause and effect? I have no idea what the answer to that is.
Do you want to get into any of the things that have happened to you?
Well, I know your show probably isn't long enough.
All right.
Because some of these things require a certain kind of explanation to be believable. And I just can say that, that I'm kind of a person that needs to have something dramatic happen, because if it's fairly minor, I might not pay any attention to it, So in my world, it's got to be something that I'm going to really notice, And so those things have happened, and those things have happened to a whole lot of other people that I know, as well, and they're dramatic, very dramatic, So I don't want to get into really. I mean, sometime we ought to just do a visit with you on your show, and I can relate a lot of these kinds of stories that have happened to me personally, and some other, maybe some of those of other folks, without touching on things that are a little too scary.
All right. Well, I'm good next Sunday. How are you? I'm just kidding.
That's
all right.
Pretty fast.
Yeah, we can set something like that up. Can I just characterize it this way, is that some of these events are pretty spooky, that the people to whom they happened were spooked by it. And I just wonder if you think that something is trying to get your attention or trying to dissuade you from pursuing this.
Well, I look at this, I'm thankful. I look at it in a positive context, and I'm thankful that in my personal case that I've had the events that I have had, and not only currently, but even years ago, and things connected to the Skinwalker Ranch, and things prior to the Skinwalker Ranch, and then during the Skinwalker Ranch, and then over the last, 5-6 months, I'm thankful for this, because to me they're like gifts. And it helps for me to stay on point. It helps for me to realize that something else is going on. Maybe something else is even paying attention in some way. I don't know, but I'm thankful that they've happened.
Well, let's talk about Skinwalker. You owned that property for 20 years, and then you sold it. And you have told me, and I don't think it's private anymore, you've told me one of the reasons why is because of the things that had happened, the things that followed you and others home. It was the term hitchhiker had been described to us. That phenomena of bringing something home, some kind of a spirit or attachment that plays havoc, that has performances that seems meant to scare people. That's real. That's happened enough times that you wanted it off your plate. Is that true?
That is true. Yeah. affected a couple of the. I think the most profound. The people who carried things home that was derogatory to their lives. Two people in particular were government people, and that bothered me a lot. And I had no way of stopping it. And same in my own home, and with other people that I knew, so with the government people, it was very dramatic, and I thought, you know, we've explored enough, and maybe it's just time for a change. And right then, an opportunity came along. Someone, you know, called me up and said, "Hey, I want to buy the ranch." And the timing was perfect.
And we're glad that Brandon Fugel has carried on the research, kind of stuff that you started a long time ago. But the hitchhiker phenomena, that really scared some of the people involved. And we don't really know what it was. As you have expressed to me before, you didn't know there were attempts to communicate with whatever it was at the ranch. Direct communication, and you have described the interaction as sometimes playful, and you felt that you were going to be able to communicate at some point, and then whatever this entity was, it would kind of cut it all off and shut it down, and sometimes in very dramatic fashion. Can you speak about what you think it was at the ranch? ET, spiritual, ultra-terrestrial? What the heck was going on there?
Well, we did multiple kinds of investigations. We did multiple kinds of games that we engaged in, different kinds of games, and multiple kinds of spontaneous picture taking, so collectively we became aware that games mattered. Games were something that were responded to, and making requests were also responded to, verified photographically. And the people taking those pictures had no idea. They were just told, "Here, point the camera that direction, and take a picture and tell me what it is that you see. You know, what do you see on your camera, on a digital camera?" And so, bottom line is, George, we didn't know who the hell we were communicating with. We didn't know, because we'd have shadows go through walls and go through a living room, what the heck is that? You know, what exactly is that shadow? You know, is it a discarnate entity, or is it something that can manifest into a three-dimensional structure of a being of some kind when it exits the room? We don't know. We didn't know. We just knew that it was bizarre, and we knew that we were not in charge. Absolutely. We are along for the friggin' ride, and that was all there was to it. We absolutely were not in charge. We were the hair on the tail of the dog.
You've described it to me as a display of sorts, a performance, that it was always one step ahead of you guys, that it would appear to different people at different times, but always under its own choice of who got to see what. You get glimpses here and there. Attempts to document it were often futile, that it was intelligent. So I'm wondering what kind of intelligence it might be. And was it trying to communicate, at least for a while, and lead you somewhere?
Well, there were many different kinds of episodes that seemed to be customized. Many, many different kinds. And it seemed to be obvious that that customization was for a particular person's benefit and observation. And they could take away with them. They could go back to where they came from, you know, if it was Virginia or Maryland, and to some agency that they worked for, and they would take that away from the ranch with them, and that was about as profound an experience that could be produced. Nothing else would be as profound in their memory that they would carry the rest of their lives as to what they witnessed and was customized for them. But it's anybody's guess as to exactly who's the cause of what was being witnessed. Like I said, we didn't know, and even though we could do things that was acted upon, and it happened many times, we were serving at the behest of whatever the phenomena was, and is.
You know, I've told the stories about Skinwalker with your permission. What the world knows about Skinwalker is based on what NIDS did during that time, during those years, this study for years. And then, you know, this phenomena, whatever it is, this intelligence kind of shut itself down. It didn't want to be hunted or pursued after a time. And so it became more difficult. But during the years you were there, there were some pretty dramatic incidents that were real. People wonder, that can't be real. How can this intelligence be so far ahead that it reads your mind, it knows what you're going to do? But that's the way it worked out, and it was elusive. You don't have a lot of physical evidence to document what happened there, but it happened.
Yeah, you have primarily photographic evidence. You have human testimony. And human testimony of more than one person and of credible people, very credible people. And, yeah, it's not something that you're going to put in the trunk of your car, you know, and drive it back to Las Vegas kind of thing. You know, you're not going to get that. We didn't, at the ranch, we didn't obtain those kinds of things. We all came away better educated about how little we know, and how diverse the events could be, and that there was definitely a relationship between how you thought, and so there appeared to be a causal effect. Related to your thinking and what would be discharged, what kind of an event would manifest. And at first you don't trust that. You know, it's like you have to have it happen multiple times. And that's why personal experiences are so helpful, because it is indelible in your mind, and you don't forget, you know, you don't forget it as easily if it's happened to you.
I know that after a while, things happened in your family, to your wife. Things happened to Colm Kelleher's wife. Things have been seen by my wife. I never saw anything on the ranch at the times I was there, but, anybody who spent a lot of time on there, it would follow you around, follow you home. And, it is a confounding mystery, but one we'll go into in the next segment here. We're talking with Robert Bigelow about Bix, his new venture, and about NIDS, the previous venture that studied Skinwalker Ranch, among other things. When we come back, we're going to segue into OSAP, the secret government investigation of UFOs and related phenomena, how it might relate to all of these other topics we've been discussing, and then into the space program that Mr. Bigelow has funded over the last 20 years or so. We'll be right back with more. Robert, one more segue from Skinwalker Ranch. You know, you own the property for a number of years and had some experiences yourself, had employees who carried things home. I wonder if you've thought whether these poltergeist type things that have happened, both associated with the ranch and now since you've delved into Bix, whether it might be the same entity or intelligence messing with you.
It's hard to say, George. It's such speculation. It's really impossible to pinpoint source or sources. And I can identify times going back decades before the ranch where I had things happen that were peculiar, that, you know, very paranormal kinds of things that happened. So I'm not sure the genesis of exactly what's the commonality or the force behind it all. You know, I'm not sure that it has a singular answer even. I don't know.
Here's what I hear from people who pester me with this, pound it away every day for years and years since we wrote the book about the ranch, is that you are a guy who keeps secrets close to the vest, and the public says, we demand you release everything from NIDS. We need to see everything. We need to see it right now. You need to open up all the files. The public should go through it. This is public information. We need to rifle through all your file drawers. Show us everything. Why is Robert Bigelow keeping it all secret? What do you say to that?
Well, some of that has to do with promises made to other people. That you have to take very seriously, and of course, the Defense Intelligence Agency we were a contractor for that agency, and you know, we can't speak for them, so you know, I think. We're being more revealing here recently than we have been than we ever have been, and so that's progress.
Well, there are a lot of factors here. For NIDS, for example, you used to have a website, and when you'd have a paper, when you had something finished and ready to go, you posted it, but you didn't post the minutes from your meetings, the confidential conversations you had with your board. You didn't publish results of any investigations if they didn't get anywhere. So, and then when the time came, you gave the green light for Colum and I to release the book, The Hunt for the Skinwalker, which told the story of pretty much everything the public knows about the ranch now. I don't know that something that is funded by you, that there should be a FOIA, that everything you produce with your own money should be public.
Yeah, some things are a fine line where, you know, you just sometimes have to pay attention to confidentialities that other people are kind of they're counting on things that are not to be disclosed, agreements, you know, obligations that you commit yourself to, and you have to respect those kinds of commitments, and you have to respect the relationships so that you can be trusted.
You mentioned about the ranch allowing certain people to see certain things for an intended result, it seemed like sometimes. That is true for the DIA scientist who came to the property, who saw something immediately while he was there, and then that resulted in the program known as OSAP, right? I mean, it was a direct correlation.
Well, yeah, we actually, that was, I'm not sure if that would happened after the program began,
it was before. Yeah, it was before. Yeah.
Yeah, that was all with those people, and you know, we already had... thanks to that program, I think that program was the watershed event that opened up the news that, gee whiz, the government had been involved in funding UFO research, and lo and behold, it was the Defense Intelligence Agency, and lo and behold, there's all kinds of reports about objects that we investigated off of the coast of San Diego that we learned about in 2008 called the Tic Tac, which wasn't revealed until about, I don't know, 9 years later. And we knew about those things. And so, but that program was a watershed event, you know, that thanks to Senator Reid and Inouye and Stevens, but particularly Harry, who had tremendous courage in supporting that program and creating that the wherewithal for that to happen. And, you know, a contract was eventually awarded to us in competition. And that was the genesis, I think, of everything from that time forward, set the direction for things being revealed later in the media.
You had, at one point, under this OSAP, which I would remind our listeners, you announced this contract with an unnamed partner on this program. A week after you signed the contract, you came on the show and you said, hey, we've launched BASS. We're going to study UFOs and other matters. We've got a partner, and you were really excited about it. And nobody really paid attention to it, but there it was if anybody wanted to follow the breadcrumbs. But BASS had as many as 50 employees at one point, and you accumulated vast archives of information from around the world. You did boots-on-the-ground investigations of UFO cases and related phenomena. What do you think you learned during that, broad strokes? And where do you think you would be if they had allowed the program to continue?
Well, see, George, that's proof that sometimes I can't keep my mouth shut, right? There's proof, absolute bona fide proof right there. Well, where would we be if we had continued? Boy, I think it could have been really huge. We were really on the cusp of something quite phenomenal. I mean, if all this other stuff is phenomenal, I'm talking really phenomenal. And so we were on the cusp of that. And I think we were viewed as being trustworthy. And I think that, what would have, could have, should have happened, who knows. But if it had continued, it could have manifested into something very extraordinary.
Well, it's a shame. You know, I hear people say it was all some sweetheart deal with you and Harry Reid, that it was a really big moneymaker, which is preposterous if people know what it was really like, how much money you put into it, both before and after the funding from the Pentagon was cut off. And, you know, if there could have been a breakthrough by now, it's a terrible shame. And hopefully somebody will do that again, though it seems unlikely, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, well, the potential was there, and it was a point in time where things came together. And sometimes it can be a very long time before that those same kinds of events can coordinate and be able to produce that kind of potential again. I don't know if it ever, and certainly not in my lifetime. I don't see that happening.
We got about 9 or 10 minutes left. I want to talk about Bigelow Aerospace. It was shut down last year, March, I think, by COVID, the governor's declaration that these are non-essential employees. But you've been on a roller coaster with NASA for years. They tell you something that is good to go and then pull the rug out from under you. You've hired people, had to move out to Las Vegas, then had to let them go because NASA changed its mind. Can you talk a bit about that ride with NASA and whether or not Bigelow Aerospace might come back?
Well, people first need to understand, like we do, working on the inside with them, is that NASA, the current NASA, is not the NASA that got us to the moon. They're not the NASA of 1969, 70, 71, 72. That NASA is gone. Right now, that NASA is gone. And so NASA essentially has lost its mojo. It is very risk-averse. It is more of a JobWorks program in many ways. It has become more or less a typical government agency. Decisions are most often made by committee, a hierarchy of managers, where nobody really wants to take responsibility for making a decision and pushing something through forward, nor do they have a lot of authority to do that. So if you try to imagine a very efficient corporation that has a sense of urgency, that recognizes that money matters, and oh, by the way, time matters, and it gets things done, just picture that, and NASA's the opposite. It's very, very frustrating. I initiated the first contract in September of 2018 with SpaceX to fly people to station. I put up $20 million as a deposit, and within just a few months, I had to cancel that because everything NASA was doing was unraveling everything that I had already prepared for. So I have money that NASA owes me that hasn't paid me. I may have to sue NASA. I may have to sue them twice. I have two different disputes with NASA, and I've hired a very prestigious Houston law firm, and NASA knows it, and they have sent a demand letter to NASA for some of the monies that they owe me on a project that's over and done with, and I may have to involve that same law firm in suing NASA on something more substantial. So, and I 20 years ago, if you'd have told me, you're going to wind up suing this agency, I have said, oh, no way. No way is that going to happen. No way. You know, who bites the hand that feeds you? Who bites the hand that could be your partner in different things? You know, you don't do that. In the ethical world of business, I would never do such a thing. But I've come to this point of frustration. There are no other choices. So they spend $20 billion a year and don't have a whole hell of a lot to show for it. So they are not the NASA that of yesteryear that they used to be at all.
So they come up with a program, we're going to launch this, we got a new rocket, we're going to develop Orion, this or that, and spend a couple of billion dollars and then cancel it. And then they come up with a new project and spend a couple billion dollars and cancel it. And sort of what happened to you. I mean, there's, you know, I hear the same thing, nitpickers on social media who will say, oh, Bigelow has made hundreds of millions of dollars from NASA, which is just not true. I mean, you spent $350 million to develop Genesis 1, Genesis 2, launch them yourself, paid for the rockets, and then you have a third spacecraft that's attached to ISS now. That's the only financial deal you had with NASA that I know of.
I've had study contracts for a few millions of dollars, I don't know, altogether, counting the beam contract and some study contracts. I don't think we exceed probably 10% of the $350 million I've already spent. I don't think we've come close to 10% of that number, $35 million. So, you know, it's, for me, it's been a bottomless pit, but a pit of passion. And I still have that passion. I would still like to really accomplish something and use the moon as a target and get private platforms in LEO, and we make the best enclosures that exist. Everybody in NASA uses Bigelow Aerospace as the standard for excellence for expandable systems. And we are far ahead of NASA ever thought of being. And we're so far ahead of anybody else ever thought of being. And the people I have laid off have been sought after fast, very quickly. They were gobbled up by other companies that I know. And I don't blame those companies for going after my people. But the fact still remains that we have a lot of patents. We have all the methodologies and the trade secrets in terms of how to assemble things, as well as make individual hardware. So I am right now just treading water, to see what will happen over the next 4 or 5 years, and I could reinvigorate my company if I saw there was substance and legitimacy to programs of NASA that actually had funding and not just smoke and mirrors. That's another big problem, is that the illegitimacy of money is all over the place. The lack of people taking responsibility and the lack of sense of urgency is horrible. It's absolutely horrible. So it's very sick, sad, and disappointing, and it's not the agency it was 50 years ago at all.
We could spend a couple hours just speaking about this, and I know that there have been announcements about other companies filled with ex-NASA staffers who are now developing inflatable habitats based on your designs that seem to be in line to get sweetheart deals from their former employers. That's another topic. We got like a minute left. Your concern, as you've expressed here before, is that China takes the high ground, that when we get back to the moon, if we ever do, that China will be there waiting for us, that China could be on Mars waiting for us if it ever happens, right?
Well, I've given lectures to hundreds of people in different forums at a time on the 67 Space Treaty. I know that document, and I understand the difference and the dichotomy between a democracy's weakness and a communistic capitalistic society, and China has a huge advantage over this country, over America and its democracy, and being able to make decisions and how to spend money, and they are, China is very wealthy, they are very predisposed to ownership. So United States, probably odds are China will, if it puts its mind to it, China can go out to the moon, and it would not be pretty what they would be able to do better than the United States could do it in a shorter time frame, in a more thorough time context of being able to claim ownership of resources.
Robert Bigelow, there's so much more we need to cover and so much detail that we didn't get into in the subjects we did cover. You have an open invitation to come back anytime you want, and good luck with BICS.
Thank you, George. Thank you very much. I appreciate this opportunity tonight. Thank you.
All right. We have links on the Coast website. If you want to check out the BICS essay contest, you have to apply first before you get into it and write your essay. But all the information is available online. We're coming up with David Brown. His book is called The Mission, about one of these NASA roller coaster rides, a mission to Europa. We'll be right back with that.